Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Objective. And today we're going to be talking about something very impactful in the culture. Certainly was when it first came out around the year 1999, The Matrix. And more recently, The Matrix Resurrection, part four of the trilogy. Lest anybody ever accused me of being unprepared, I spent the last day or two watching Matrix part two, three, and then four in preparation for this, so that I could discuss this topic with the very prestigious and knowledgeable co-host here on the show, Don Watkins. How you doing?
Good, man. How's it going?
Pretty good. Definitely very confused by The Matrix, so hopefully you were able to understand it better than I could. What did you think?
Well, I mean, I want to say a lot of positive stuff about it, but one thing I will say is that one thing I thought was incredible about the first is that it's a complex story, particularly I think a lot of people don't remember. It was unlike anything that had been done. Now everybody copied The Matrix. And so you have these worlds inside worlds and, you know, movies like Inception where you're, what the heck's going on? But that was, if not unprecedented, the way that The Matrix had did it in 1999 was extremely cutting edge. And yet, as somebody who's not a huge sci-fi fan and gets confused by those things easily, that first movie was incredibly clear. You were only confused when they wanted you to be confused right at the beginning when you're in this mysterious world. But by the midpoint of the novel, you get why things are happening. You understand at every point characters' motivations. You can even like follow the fight scenes, which is something that's been really lost in Hollywood today. And unfortunately, I think one of the negatives I found about the new one, and I think this is true of the original two sequels as well, is that that kind of clarity is missing in many, many cases. And yet I think the more complex your story, the more clarity becomes vital in order to sustain us through these complicated worlds.
Mm-hmm. So the original Matrix I watched when I was 12, and of course the action was awesome. And I think one of the things that appealed to me about it was that this guy, he hates his mundane life and he just walks away from it completely. He's just able to step into this other dimension where he's this indestructible kind of sexy character. So the first Matrix to me was sexy. Like, even though they're living underground and it's kind of an ugly place to exist when the food is bad, but they're able to fight Kung Fu. And I remember feeling very good at the end of the first Matrix. Then when the second one came out a couple years later, I remember there's now like a biblical element to it. Like their society is called Zion and their ship is called Nebuchadnezzar. And Morpheus is preaching a sermon on the mount. Jesus, this to me. So looking back on it now, it, in a weird poetic kind of way, it kind of shows how initial skepticism, such as The Matrix 1 saying the world of appearances is, you know, can't be trusted. That sort of gives way to mystical sort of religious type of stuff that kind of fills its place. That's kind of how I look at it now, looking back. And then The Matrix 3 I watched the other day to kind of get caught up. Completely void of any intellectual stimulation from what I recall. And then the very newest one, kind of dumb. I mean, intellectually, there's not very much intellectual stuff happening. What did you think of the very newest one intellectually? Was there a philosophical element did you think that was very unusual or very remarkable?
Well, we should get into the philosophy, but one thing that you mentioned about the first one, I think is really true. I mean, it's really a Harry Potter type story, right? It's a chosen one plucked from a boring life and whizzed into a world where they're really important and where things are, you know, for Harry, thankfully, much more fun, albeit dangerous than he thought they were. With The Matrix, things are much more horrible, but you're the one who's going to help save and fix us. And I think those kinds of chosen one stories can be really interesting, really exciting. And to the extent that there's kind of a, not philosophy, but to the extent that there's kind of a deeper meaning to the films, I actually think that more basic idea of, hey, there's more to life than it can feel stuck in, you know, your boring 9-to-5 or in, you know, your hellish foster parents' house. I think that is kind of a really powerful story to tell, because many people do feel that way. And having that idea that there's something more can really resonate with us. But I think the thing that always amused me and I found very funny about the reaction to the first one was, like, it made people often are attracted to stories that make them kind of feel smarter. Like, if you remember Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code, like, oh, I'm reading a mystery thriller novel, but I'm learning so much about all of these, you know, ancient and religious secrets and so on. And here it was like, oh, I'm getting to think deep thoughts about philosophy. And unfortunately, it's like the worst side of philosophy, which is, what if reality isn't real? And this goes back, it goes back to many sources, but one that others have pointed out is Descartes' idea of, how can we know anything? Maybe everything I see around me is just created by an evil demon who's trying to trick me. And so that was supposedly the deep philosophic question of the Matrix, of what if reality is an illusion, which is a dumb question. The whole starting point of philosophy is, we have knowledge, and then how do we distinguish errors and mistakes and legitimate knowledge from illegitimate? And so you can't start by doubting everything. What you need to do is figure out, all right, well, what is the process that we go through that enables us to reach real legitimate knowledge? And all this kind of, is reality an illusion? It falls into the category of the arbitrary. It's like, you know, well, what if, you know, your dad is really Santa Claus? And what if Santa Claus is really real? Like, it's make-believe kind of non-thinking. But there is real philosophy in the Matrix, particularly around the question of free will. And the kind of, it raises what's been a perennial question in philosophy that religious thinkers wrestled with, which was, so if God knows everything, he knows what I'm going to do, then how can I have free will? Like, I can't choose to do what God doesn't think I'm going to do, because that would make him wrong. That would make him fallible. And in the Matrix, you get this idea of, like, all right, Neo has this, he's fated to be the one who's going to save things and so on. And it's, all right, well, then is he even making choices? And this comes up in kind of various places throughout it. And then it gets echoed again in the new one, where a few times there's this line that I'm probably going to botch, but it's basically something like, you think you're making a choice, but it's not really a choice. And the idea is, given who you are and what you value, there is no choice, even if you feel that you have one. And so this is kind of a slightly different idea. It's not so much there's fate, therefore you can't do anything else. It's sort of like, you have values, therefore you can't do anything but pursue them. And objectivism has a really interesting, I think, analysis of that kind of objection to free will, which is, don't we just do what we, like, most want to do? And so, you know, what does free will really consist of? So I do think that there's philosophy in there. I don't think it's what's most interesting about the films. I think in the end, what's most interesting, certainly about this fourth one, is the love story, which didn't really resonate for me in the first three films between Neo and Trinity, but I thought was extremely powerful in the fourth one and one of the best facets of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you understand, because I'm not sure I do, the setting of this new Matrix movie, The Resurrection, is Neo or Tom Anderson, did he return from the noumenal, whatever it is, the Matrix, or he returned to the Matrix and he remembers kind of what happened, but now, like, he's back? Is that the idea? And for the last 20 years, he didn't know who to talk to, but he created this video game that's based on what took place in Never Never Land over there. Is that kind of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, some parts of the answer to that, I think, are spoilers, but I think it's not a spoiler to say that, yeah, I mean, he's back in the Matrix, and there's a question of, well, didn't he die? Like, but that's answered later in the film. But he's back in the Matrix, but it's not the same Matrix. The Matrix has evolved. And one of the interesting things, and one of the things I really like about the film, is that it was both, I think, really loyal to the first three, but very fresh in a lot of what it did. And in particular, the new Matrix really, if you think about the old Matrix, kind of reflected the internet circa 1999 and society circa 1999. He's an office worker in a boring job. I grew up in the era of movies like Office Space, where that was like the you know, this is was the tragedy of the world, was that you go to a corporate job and have to fill, what were they called, PRS or PTS reports or whatever that was. And here it's that he's trapped in a new matrix, which is much more like our world, where it's not people kind of brain dead zombies in corporate America. It's people who are overstimulated thanks to social media and video games. And yeah, he created this video game based off of his memories that he of what he did as Neo, that his therapist is trying to like help tell him, hey, like, no, those are fantasies. Those are delusions. They led you to almost commit suicide. Let's like keep taking your blue pill. Literally, he's on a regimen of blue pills. And that's sort of where he is at the beginning. And I think it's one of the most enjoyable parts of the film is in the first act. You know, he created this super successful trilogy of video games, The Matrix, that are exactly like the movies. And now he's being asked to do a fourth, a reboot 20 years later. And you see his colleagues wrestling with what was it that was so appealing about the first one? Was it about capitalist exploitation and oppression? Was it about, you know, trans issues? And they're really kind of reflecting on the legacy of the films within the movie, which could have gone really wrong and been too cutesy, but I thought was quite effective the way they did it.
I'm generally not a fan of serious movies breaking the fourth wall. And when his work partner, who I guess is also Smith or something, like was telling him, Warner Brothers, our parent company, decided to do a part four of the with or without us. I'm like, oh, come on. So I cringed a little bit at that. But I understand it. There's something endearing about some of it. But like my reoccurring thought through watching this new Matrix was like, this has nothing to do with the first Matrix anymore in terms of tone and style and just the general feeling that I get from it. At this point, it's like they're just, I don't know, beating a dead horse is the right word. I mean, I hate to say necrophilia is kind of what it feels like at a certain point. But I mean, reboots are a thing. People do them. They did it with Full House. They do it with Ghostbusters. They're going to keep doing these. And, you know, for me to just sit here and criticize it all day, at a certain point I need to ask myself, like, why is this my problem? Why do I need to be so negative? So I decided as I was watching it to just kind of go with it. I remember, I think this was you and Greg Salmieri who did an episode a few months ago, and you mentioned The Matrix and touched upon a little bit how how do you know that the underground dumpster that they're all living in, I guess Zion or that whole, the real world, how do they know that's real? Like, how do, just because their senses are telling them, like, How come this world, what makes this world fake, but that one real, and many other sort of disbeliefs you must suspend to kind of go with this. So I kind of look at, you know, Anderson or Neo returning to this world. Like, why does it need to be a bad thing? Like, okay, you're here now. There are challenges. There are goals. There are values to pursue. Create a video game. And maybe, I don't know, I hate to say this, I know this is not a Hollywood blockbuster thing to say, but find a new girlfriend maybe after 20 years. Like, I understand Trinity was your favorite, she was the one, but at a certain point, like, you do need to move on, right? And that got me asking, well, she was the one for him and he's the one, and what exactly is the one, by the way? Like, the one, the chosen one, chosen by who? So like, just what objective is called intrinsicism is throughout this whole universe of the Matrix. And I think you see this a lot in a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, you know, intrinsicism, like there's intrinsic value and an intrinsic hierarchy, like independent of people's value judgments and contexts. So those are some of the thoughts I had while watching.
Yeah. I mean, I come at it, I think, a little bit differently. And I think partly had a more positive reaction because of it. I mean, look, you know, you have to take the movie to a certain extent in its own terms. And the fact that like these are people who weren't just in love, but like basically died for one another. And now like they're reunited without their memories, and they both have this faint feeling of connectedness that certainly is awakened in him and starts to awaken in her, and he can't get away from it. You know, I find that really charming and powerful, and found some of the scenes heartbreaking, particularly in that I thought they handled it with subtlety that, usually a film like The Matrix kind of over, what's the word, like over narrates things and over explains them. And I thought that the scenes where you're sensing the connection between them, but it's not like articulated yet, were just done in a really kind of powerful way where the emotion was there, but it wasn't being kind of like, you know, hammered over your head. And so I think that's kind of what held this movie together, was this, the fact that like, oh, I want Neo and Trinity to reunite. And it's kind of like, yeah, then they'll destroy the machines or whatever they're going to do. But, you know, it was more about that for me. And I saw that as the essence of the story. I do think one way in which, you know, what really made the first work is part of like Neo being the one, is you see this kind of ordinary guy who is called to adventure as, you know, the chosen one, and then who grows into this kind of superhero, and seeing that transformation is extraordinarily powerful. And in this one, I think Neo just gets undercut. Like, he's saved at crucial moments when you want him to be the one who's kind of stepping up. And even I'm trying to decide whether to give a spoiler, but there's just a point at the end where you're thinking that it's kind of going to be maybe like Neo and Trinity together who are going to be the source, you know, who are able to save themselves, and Neo kind of just get saved. So Neo is just more passive in this one in certain places than I would have liked to see. And so there wasn't like, there was a little less of that kind of heroic feeling that you get from the first one. And that's really a shame, because I understand making it like enlarging it, so it's not just Neo. We're going to, let's say, make Trinity more crucial to the, you know, battle against evil. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you have to diminish Neo. And I think this film sort of did to an extent.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the romantic connection between them, yeah, I guess I'll walk back a little bit of my kind of cynicism or whatever it is. Like, I guess I understand, like, in art, you know, having him be hung up on her for 20 years because their connection was, it was deeper than anything casual. I guess, yeah, I can see why that makes for good art. Now.
Yeah. I mean, imagine if Francisco, like, you know, a few years in, or Galt, you know, a few years into the strike, are like, man, I guess Dagny's got other things to do. I'm gonna go hook up with the Fisher chick.
I mean, yeah, there's so many ways that art should not be a literal instruction manual. I mean, just even right. Howard Roark and Dominique, I would discourage anyone from waiting for a girl who married two other men. I mean, there's just so many ways in which art is art and life is life. And how to abstract the correct things from art is a rich topic. So in our own way, we can all be Neo. In our own way, we can avoid the facades and look for the truth and all of that. The part that made me roll my eyes a little bit, and I think this might have something to do with Neo being a little bit less heroic in this movie, is, did you think the movie kind of was trying to work in some girl power sort of feminist stuff, where like Neo can't be too tough, can't be too strong, and at one point Trinity, okay, spoiler alert, everybody mute and fast forward or something, Trinity, she just kind of like walks away from her husband and kids. Did that, do you think that was kind of a feminist thing? Like, I mean, you want to talk about what you need to suspend your disbelief for, like a mother of two or three kids just kind of like goes like, oh, no, they don't really exist, and just completely runs away. Something about it just seemed, first of all, unbelievable. And also, like, I was wondering, were they trying, was this part of the trend we've seen in movies where, you know, girls rule and boys drool, that they keep on pushing in a lot of movies? I feel,
I certainly didn't come away with the sense of an agenda on that front. There's definitely, I think, nods to, I mean, look, the directors are both trans, or the original creators are both transgender, and then one of them returned for this film. And I think there were, you know, nods to that in various ways, but I didn't feel any of the agenda come through. The scene that you mentioned, and I'm sorry to harp on a spoiler for people, but what the heck, you know, it's been out for a week. That's more than enough to see it, or I guess less than a week. But in any case, I actually thought that was one of the most atrociously handled moments, because it was one of the most important moments. And really, it was the most important moment in the movie, right? This was when the thing that you've been waiting to happen is going to happen. And Neo and Trinity, who hasn't yet realized that she's Trinity or admitted it to herself, have this kind of long conversation about it. And she says, no, I'm going to stick with my family. Basically, the family runs in. I think having the kids appear with the dad to say, take her away, like, come with us, that was a mistake for exactly the reason you mentioned, which is that even if you have it intellectually as, yeah, well, these people are only, you know, that's her computer generated family. They're still people in the same way that she's a person living inside the matrix. And the idea is, what, she doesn't care about her kids anymore. Like, it's you that they should have been left off stage so that we can fully be invested in the moment. And then the way that they did it was, she basically says no to Neo. And then just 30 seconds later says yes, out of the blue, without any reason why. Why did it take her 30 seconds to change her mind? It was really because they just wanted to draw out the drama, right? If she had just said yes, that wouldn't have been good enough. But having her say arbitrarily yes after she says no, that to me, it just killed what should have been a powerful emotional moment. Emotional moment.
Well, one man's arbitrary whim is another's prophecy and a divine revelation, which is throughout the Matrix series, I've noticed. I think that's what they're trying to do. It's constant. Everything's just this emotional, like, regurgitation or something. It's just kind of out of the blue. Someone knows this, knows that. When at one point in this new Matrix, when the one young lady is saying that she saw Neo somewhere. And at first it sounds like she's saying, like, she knew it was him because, oh, like, because my eyes saw, I know he's still alive because my eyes saw him. And I'm thinking, okay, cool. Like, you know, the senses are valid. They're introducing a little bit of a good old scientific approach to things. She knows Neo's alive because she saw him. And then she goes on and says, although he didn't look like Neo, but I knew it somehow. Like, I felt it, right? That's kind of what she said. Like, okay, so we're back to where we were. We're back to just, everyone can feel it and they don't actually need to look for evidence or proof. It just, I feel it. And therefore I'm going to, you know, go by that. So that is, these revelations and prophecies are throughout the series, which to me is way less cool than what I remember feeling watching the very first Matrix. The very first Matrix, yeah, there's something supernatural about it, but like, you know, it's like, it's to what end? So that this Kung Fu master can fight these, you know, these agents. And I feel like that might have been kind of a Hollywood jab at their representation to have the bad guys be called agents. But anyway, that this Kung Fu master can beat up anybody and he's got this hot girlfriend and they're going to fight and they're going to beat the bad guys. That to me is cool. But then these movie after movie where the plot can change anytime someone has some revelation occur to them, to me seems kind of like much less interesting. I don't know if your experience is the same.
Yeah, I don't love that either, but I don't have too big a problem with it in the sense that I think that that's just kind of a trope of the genre. Like any kind of epic fantasy or even like this kind of straddles sci-fi fantasy, any of these epic sci-fi fantasies, like having just, you know, characters who, you know things through gut instinct or whatever, it's, to me, it feels a little lazy, but it's just sort of standard fare in these things. So it doesn't affect me the way that it would, like, if, you know, you just had something that's supposedly set in like, you know, if you're just watching like a mystery and the detective just knows, looking at it, like that's the solution to the case or something like that. That would have bothered me quite a bit. But so you do raise a point that, like, so one of the most famous memes to come out of it, the original Matrix, if you will, is the red pill versus blue pill, right? And it's, do you want this phony, wonderful world of the Matrix where you're happy and satisfied, but it's an illusion? Or do you want the truth? And sort of like taking the red pill has been, you know, translated into like, all right, I'm willing to face the truth. But it's it's from a totally religious context, even the way we use it in the culture, because the idea is that to open your eyes to the truth is really just to like accept the revelation. Whereas if you, to be committed to the truth is an ongoing process of using your mind, trying to understand things. There's no, I flipped the switch and one day I believed one thing and then I got the truth. And so all of these people like, oh, I've been red-pilled and that means I see the truth. What it really means is I've joined a new religion. And so like anybody who wants a metaphor for the truth, like taking a pill should be the last thing that you resort to. It's the truth in the same way that like, you know, a person says, I got baptized and saw Jesus Christ. And like, now I have the truth. It's not the truth in the sense of like what a person should be, which is fidelity towards reality gained through reason. And so I've always balked at that analogy, and it's kind of proper that it's been usurped by kind of the neo-religious political tribes of today, to say nothing of the, you know, pickup artist community, which I think also has taken it up, or I guess it's the manosphere community, whatever.
Oh yeah, people have definitely, that meme is, yeah, the men's rights, manosphere, whatever they are, they've definitely taken that red pill. I mean, the idea is, I mean, and we can use this even with, you know, with a good philosophy, we could say, well, you know, once you're red pilled, kind of once you get it, you get it. But the idea, the fact that it's taking a pill is not exactly a great symbolism. There was an alt-right lady, for Goldie something, Faith Goldie. I don't think it's defamatory to call her alt-right. I think she was very kind of openly, whatever. She ran for mayor of Toronto, I think, at one point. And I remember her tweeting, you know, the Enlightenment was the most blue-pilled and, you know, like stupid, pointless, whatever. She called the Enlightenment blue-pilled. And I think it's, you know, it's good to see people who represent that worldview speaking out, differentiating themselves, distancing themselves from the Enlightenment. But isn't that interesting? She says the Enlightenment was blue-pilled. And now what do you get when you take the blue pill? You're living in this world where your evidence gives you, you know, you follow the evidence of your senses. Basically, the scientific method as we know it today, or much of the scientific revolution came about from Enlightenment philosophers and Enlightenment thinkers. It's just, there's something ironic about this, this like racial collectivists pointing at the Enlightenment saying, well, that's blue pilled. I mean, is blue pilled even an insult when, I don't know, it kind of came to mind recently, I guess, watching the Matrix movies. So,
yeah, I mean, it's, yeah. That's what I said, let them own the analogy. And, you know, there's definitely such a thing as like, my eyes were open, but your eyes being open is not, you get it. Your eyes are open is I'm going to go on a journey now. And the journey is towards knowledge. So like, you can have the experience of like Ayn Rand opened my eyes that there could be this different way of thinking about life and a different kind of life I could lead. But you don't, it's not like getting a revelation. It's like getting somebody going, hey man, go on this journey. And then, okay, well, I'm going to go on this journey and see where it leads. I'm going to think through these issues in a way I haven't thought through before. I'm going to question the existence of God. I'm going to question conventional morality. I'm going to question the, you know, political divide as it's conventionally thought about and taught. And yeah, then maybe with some hard work over a course of a couple years or more, you might end up with a whole new philosophy, but it should feel completely different and talked about in a completely different way than like, I've swallowed something, which is what the kind of religious conversion experience is like for many people.
Yeah. And I just found it especially remarkable that someone would call the Enlightenment blue pilled. And when like to me, the blue pill makes a lot more sense than the red one, even like looking at the Matrix, like this world where you can trust your senses to me is much more rational.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is one of the things that I really balk at. I mean, it's fine if you want to do this within a story, but if this is really your theme that you're taking, which is the choice being happy and ignorant versus like miserable, but on the side of the truth. And that's a dichotomy that shows up all through art and a lot through people's thinking. And indeed, one of the objections to objectivism is, well, look, if you were really selfish, why would you be for honesty? Because people have this idea of like your interest versus reality, your interest versus the truth. And objectivism's whole perspective is that, no, the truth is what allows you to adhere to and navigate your way through the world. And that means it's vital and central to the achievement of anything valuable. So it's like, no, I want happiness. That's why I'm going to open my eyes. That's why I'm going to be committed to reality. And it's true that on a particular issue and in the short term, it can certainly feel like, all right, am I going to be kind of ignorant and happy versus face the painful truth? Certainly, you know, that comes up for in many cases. I mean, the reason people evade often is because they choose exactly that. They don't want to face painful facts, usually about themselves. They want that kind of temporary, they want that illusion of like happiness at the price of truth, but it's an illusion. Like that's the real illusion, is that you can have happiness at the price of the truth. And to be generous to the matrix, arguably that's part of the point, is that the people in the matrix, they're not really happy. I mean, when we see Anderson before in the first film, before he takes the red pill, he's not happy. His life's just kind of going by in this sort of empty way and so on. And in this new one, even though he has, you know, he's one of the most famous people in the culture and works at this company that has become incredibly successful on his shoulders, he's not happy. And there, you could read that as, look, you can't really live a happy, satisfying, meaningful life in a way that's cut off from what's true. And I'll be happy to grant them that if that's what they were going for. But that's certainly not what people tend to take away from it.
Yeah, this this sort of dichotomy between happiness and even just intellect in general seems to pervade. And that, like, happiness versus knowledge, like ignorance is bliss. There's all these things are out there. I guess the sort of red pill symbolism you can apply to objectivism would be like, once you realize like, oh, there's this theory of history, how like philosophy has influenced history, and you can look at the culture and see the way that different ideas have shaped the culture we live in. I think there's sort of the kind of what people often mean when they talk about being red pilled, whether they're objectivist or not. I mean, often they're not objectivist, but like they're saying like, oh, now I see past the feminism and I see past the postmodernism and I see past the way the media has manipulated us. So that's kind of what they're getting at.
This is the way that I think about the Matrix as an analogy, or as kind of a, you know, symbol philosophically, that I think is really right, which is a culture's philosophy is or can be the Matrix, right? Because what it is it's something that surrounds you. It shapes everything that you see and think. And it takes a real effort and a real courage to step back and question it. And to think, well, everybody takes it for granted that it's wrong to be selfish. Are they right? Or everybody believes in the Christian God. You know, let's go back a couple hundred years in this country, right? Is that true? The whole science of philosophy is really about stepping back from the assumptions that we're making and identifying those as assumptions, and then learning how to question them in a rigorous, logical sort of way. And so, I mean, really what philosophy does is it can create a matrix. It can create a world of assumptions, many of them false and destructive. But then it's also the very thing that will get you out of it. That is, if you engage in philosophic thinking, you're no longer controlled by that, because you've validated the ideas that you're using to understand the world and to organize your life.
Yeah. Okay. Let me plug the book Objectivism, The Philosophy of Ayn Rand, to anyone who hasn't read it. Recently re-released, the 30th anniversary edition. It is, you know, once you take that red pill, so to speak, you just can't unsee it. You know, like you hear all these philosophical statements being made in the movie like Matrix, and you're able to ask like, okay, but by what standard? Where are you setting the bar? What does it mean to have purpose? Your own life is not a good enough purpose. Your own values are not. But what, flying into a bunch of machines to protect a bunch of peasants in the middle of an underground society somewhere is like, what? By what standard? I mean, there's many ways by which you can sort of identify these things. You can detect philosophical premises. So I really can't plug that book enough at a time like this. Let's read some super chats, shall we? We got Shazbot with 1999 says that, and that was the year The Matrix came out. Can you discuss the pro reason? Well, is it a sign? Can you discuss the pro reason attitude of the general from the city of Io? I consider her to be the hero of the story. If only the loose cannons would listen to her.
I don't remember well enough what she was saying in her arguments. I mean, she does actually, you know, we're supposed to see her not as a villain, but she's certainly an obstacle to what we want to see, which is Neo go and save Trinity. But she raises like a really good point. Why are we going to throw the people into risk? Like, are you willing to risk all of these people because maybe you'll be able to hook up with your chick? I mean, essentially, like I'm mocking a little bit. But I mean, she's kind of taking a really principled position. I'd have to watch it again to see how much to have a real view of her role and how much she sticks to it. So it might be fresher in your mind, Rucka.
I mean, yes, I did watch it, all of these movies more recently, but I was really bad at kind of like paying attention to all the different characters and stuff.
I mean, so. The problem is by the time we got to her, that's when the story for me got very convoluted. And so it was harder to like think about like the characters' motivations and things. And but I wish I had paid more attention to her, 'cause she was, I think, the most interesting character in many ways. And other than like the, you know, major characters, like she was taking really bold actions and really wrestling with them in a way that was surprising for a minor character. You usually don't get that kind of richness from a character who's really more there to be an obstacle than anything else.
Mm-hmm. All right. Marilyn with 99 cents. Marilyn again with $2. Marilyn with $5 says, what about Rourke and Dominique? Should one of them have moved on? Or maybe that isn't analogous? Well, it's art. And Ayn Rand is the god of that universe and knows what Dominique is going, where she's going to end up. I mean, this is, you know, my best answer that I could come up with. Rourke is who he is. And he tells her, I'm going to wait for you while you go out there and figure this stuff out. And I'm confident you'll figure it out. In real life, I would not advise anybody to approach that way, to approach relationships that way. If you're breaking up with somebody, assume it's over. And, you know, and when they marry somebody else, do not wait for them. So that's, art is one thing and real life is quite another, but you can abstract certain qualities from all that. Would you agree with my take?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with what you said there. I mean, part of what's going on in The Fountainhead, though, is that we see the same phenomenon between Rourke and Dominique between Rourke and his work. That is, Rourke knows that he's unconventional, that he is, you know, he thinks about life and his work in ways that are very different from other people. And he knows that he's going to have to wait for others to come around. So with his buildings, he doesn't expect the whole world to immediately go, oh, these are wonderful, these are awesome. He expects a few people to get it. And he's just going to keep building and wait for those people. And with Dominique, I think it's a similar thing where he's not surprised that she has kind of wrong premises about whether or not he can succeed in the world. And so his idea is, yeah, well, I have to wait for my kind of person, in this case, my kind of lover, to come around and see it. So I think there's a real reason. There's a number of reasons why the book plays out the way that it does. But yes, this is a good example of why, even if a novelist is really trying to make important points about life, it's not that a novelist is rarely saying the right way to act is exactly the way my characters act. Ayn Rand certainly didn't have that view. You know, she's trying to illustrate, she's telling a story about particular characters, and there's certain universal principles that we can learn from them. But the universal principle is not like, hey, if you're really into some chick, like, you know, wait for a couple divorces and then she'll come back to you once she realizes you were right all along. That's probably not the right approach.
Yeah, I know this is kind of a tangent. When I read The Fountainhead as a teenager, it felt like Rourke was like this Neo, like the one who has this like effortless ability to attract this magnificent girl, and she's just helpless around him. And that, you know, I think that probably appealed to me. But I mean, in reality, the pursuit of various values is like the effort you put into it, and then achieving that, like achieving it is the reward. If it was effortless, as I thought it was when reading the book, if things were effortless, they wouldn't really be valuable, or they wouldn't be satisfactory. They wouldn't be satisfying. You want to learn how to achieve values, whether it's in romance, whether it's in career or anything else, in fitness, whatever it is. You don't want to float through the air like Neo in part three of The Matrix, or part two. Like you don't want to just be this consciousness that transcends the body, which I think is kind of what they did at the end of Matrix 3. Like that's kind of, you know, this primacy of consciousness, like the ideal is to not even have a body anymore and just be this like perfectly perfect consciousness with no limitations whatsoever. Where's the satisfaction in that? Where's the happiness? How is happiness to come in such a state? So there's my little tangent. Allison with $2 says, what y'all think of NPH character, the analyst? Do you know what?
Oh, Neil Patrick Harris.
Oh,
let's see. I mean, I love Neil Patrick Harris so much that even I don't really know what I think about. It's kind of a little bit of a one note character, but it had some of the kind of like smarmy, funny, villainous, you know, side of him that I really like. So I don't know. You have to ask me like in a few weeks, like, do I really think it holds together? But I really enjoyed watching him. I don't think every scene or everything that they had this character do quite worked. But I mean, I just am a huge fan of his, so I'll watch him in anything.
Doogie Howser grew up and became a therapist is what I was thinking watching. I mean, like, look, by the time he's in that movie, I am so no longer excited about the whole Matrix movie series that there's not much more damage he could do. Jonathan Honig with $2, whoever that is, you know what would be funny? Hey, Jonathan, mute the video for a minute. It'd be funny if like we pulled like a big Twilight Zone style prank on Jonathan and just everyone just doesn't know who he is and doesn't remember him. And like, he would think suddenly he's in the wrong Matrix or something. So that's something I'd like to do if we can organize that. Roland with 499 euros says, wasn't it the same guy who ended the Enlightenment who introduced the blue pill, red pill dichotomy in the first place? I'm guessing he's referring to Kant.
Yeah. I mean, some people have compared the Matrix to Kant. I mean, I guess you can make that in the sense of, you know, he's creating two realities, but I didn't find it particularly Kantian, because the whole issue with Kant is that there's not, you can't access the other reality. Neo just has to get unplugged, and like now he's in really real reality, right? So, I mean, with Kant, the thing is you couldn't actually like ever get out of the Matrix. Even God can't get out of the Matrix because he perceives the world through some godly means. And if you have a means of awareness, then that means you don't have awareness in Kant's view. So you couldn't really like execute on it. But people have made that argument. They have made that kind of comparison.
Yeah. And I would think it's only it's only a matter of time. Once one philosopher says there's this other true world out there we have no access to, it's only a matter of time before another philosopher comes along and says, oh, I do have access to that real world. And I think the point that like Peikoff makes in The Ominous Parallels is that people like Hitler are there accessing this other world, the true world, and they're communicating it like a prophet would to the masses. Okay. Enric with 499 says, thanks for the depth. I don't mind the spoilers. We'll be seeing it. All right. Works for me. I guess one more point, even though we've gone for a very long time, is just that like how like I've seen this in other movies too, where like the machines can actually be our friends. Like at first the machines were the enemy, but now in this newest one, the robots are, some of them are on they've joined the humans and are cooperating. And I've seen a lot of this in movies where like they try to dumb down the differences between human, machine, and animal, like ape, for instance. So like, we're not as smart as we think we are, so we're more like the animals. The animals are smarter than we think, so they're more like us. We are basically determined, so we're more like the machines, and the machines are capable of love, so they're more like us. I've seen this sort of blurring of the distinction in movies, and I guess it makes for good entertainment, but I wonder if there's a certain belief in that blurriness or lack of distinction that goes into that writing, I've wondered. What did you make of the machines being friends with the humans in this newest Matrix?
I didn't have any deep thoughts on it. I just thought it was kind of a cool little twist. I mean, you know, you do raise a point, which is in effect, like, do the machines really have any like interest in us? Like, if we're clearly not as powerful as they are, like, what are we bringing to the table? And maybe they said something to answer that, and I'm just forgetting. But I thought it was kind of cool the way they did it. And I mean, one of the things I liked was that you saw in the real world progress. And one of the concerns that's addressed by the movie is like, all right, and this happens many times in sequels, is, all right, we've just achieved something great, and then we have to undo it in order to have a sequel, right? Like, first you tell a love story, and then, well, if we have a sequel, we've got to break the people up. And it's like, well, why did we go through all of that? And those kinds of things I really don't like when the later movies undermine the first ones. And I think they did a good job of, even though that's Neo's concern, is, wait, did everything, you know, did I do everything for nothing? Said no, like, things have changed, things are improved, and they even have progress in technology. We're like, hey, we're trying to grow, instead of eating gruel, now we're gonna have strawberries because we're working with the machines. And so in that sense, I liked how they really tried to move the world forward in new sort of interesting ways.
Yeah, I was a bit more cynical. So I'm just like, so their end goal is what? To have a world where with blue skies and strawberries, kind of like the one they chose to walk away from in the first place. But I know it's I'm being difficult. All right. Coming up today, James Valiant and Lisa Van Dam are discussing The Comprachicos, an article by Ayn Rand. That's at 8:30 UK time. And then at 10 p.m. UK time, Kirk Barbera interviews Sandra Shaw, author of Windows on Humanity. Now, Sandra Shaw, among her many accomplishments, organized the famous debate between Peikoff and Ridpath versus a couple of socialist, democratic, socialist, egalitarian types back in the 1980s. The video on YouTube has gotten a lot of views, and many people learned about Ayn Rand through that famous debate. So that's one of the many things people might know from Sandra Shaw. I think she's a sculptress. Not sure what the correct word is these days. You know, do you know actresses are not called actors?
Well, I thought that was always true.
Well,
that actors was the generic term. Hey, so I never know when to use actor, actress.
You're not supposed to know. That's how the left works. I'm just joking around. All right, everybody. I guess we got a few minutes to jump over to Clubhouse. I'll jump over there if you're free, Don. I'll see you over there. Cool. Thanks. Thanks for a great discussion, Don. And see you all back here tomorrow, same time, for the Daily Objective. And goodbye.